And a very warm welcome, everyone, for tonight's discussion on is there a place for guarantees in the DC market? I'm Andrew Slater and I'm your chair for this evening. Before we commence the discussion, I need to mention a few housekeeping rules. The fire alarm for this building is a continuous ringing alarm. Should this go off during the meeting, please make your way to the assembly point, which is outside the Melton Mowbray Public House, the exit through the archway and turn to your right. Anyone wishing to claim CPD for this meeting should sign the forms that are at the registration desk. These are for auditing purposes only. You are responsible for entering the CPD on your online record. Finally, may I ask you to turn off your mobile phones and BlackBerries and iPads and such like, as these interfere with the sound system. It is not sufficient to mute the ringing tone. Your phone or BlackBerry will still try to talk to its base, and this is picked up by our equipment. The meeting tonight will take a different format in that the authors, seated either side of me, are going to present a summary of the work to date of the working party. After that, we will open the floor for discussion, which will help them shape the final paper. So it's as much your meeting as it is theirs. Please do not let the fact that the meeting is being recorded deter you from contributing. You will be given the opportunity to edit your remarks before publication in the British Actuarial Journal, and for that reason, you must clearly state your name and company, preferably, before making your contribution. Please either speak from the lectern or wait for a microphone to be brought to you before you begin your contribution. I believe we have one guest attending tonight, Bianca Garland, who's a policy advisor at the Saving and Retirement to the ABI. We have two speakers. On my right is Scott Eason. He is a qualified actuary and heads the advisory team for UK insurers at Société Générale, focusing on risk management, yield enhancement and saving products. He joined Société Générale in 2009 after spells running his own consultancy business for UK insurers and as an investment strategy actuary at Legal & General. His early career consisted of over 10 years in the insurance and financial services practice of Watson Wyatt. I think the fact is Watson Wyatt gives you an idea of how old he is, or how long ago it was. Gillian Frugi, on my left, is a consulting actuary working in the risk and financial services segment of Towers Watson in London since 1991. She specialises in life assurance product design and distribution strategies with a particular interest in variable annuity business. She is currently a member of the Towers Watson European Asset Liability Initiative with particular responsibility for variable annuity hedging. So, with that, Scott, I hand over to you.
Try and keep it brief so we can get out afterwards. Gillian and I are presenting this session on behalf of the Investment Products for Retirement Savings Working Party. You can tell we think it's a hot topic because we didn't debate our name. The Working Party has been running for over 18 months now, initially presented at the Firm Conference in June 2011 on the challenges facing DC. Since then, we narrowed our focus onto the topic of whether there is a place in the UK mass market for a guaranteed pensions product. As Andrew said, we're in the process of producing a formal report of our work, and a draft paper setting out our progress to date and intended future work was circulated ahead of this session. Our view is that defined benefit schemes have proven to be too expensive for providers, but the working group is concerned that defined contribution schemes, as currently practiced, are not the best alternative. We believe that there is significant risk that DC will not provide sufficient retirement income for members through insufficient investment returns and contribution rates not being high enough. This could lead to significant social cost. With auto-enrolment coming, this issue is only going to get bigger, and we see it as a ticking time bomb. Our presentation follows the order of the paper. We look at wants and needs of individuals and other stakeholders. We look at pension systems around the world and methods of providing guarantees. In the paper, we state a desire to carry out a comparison of the various approaches. Hot off the press, we have the first results of this analysis, and whilst not finished, it starts to help give weight to our initial conclusions. So So what do people want and need? There's no point in designing a pension scheme that is neither wanted or needed. Equally, the distinction between wants and needs is important. Clearly, an individual is going to want the best pension they can have, but are they willing to gamble on the level of this? The need is that they have is the level of income provides them with a certain level of lifestyle in retirement. Large amounts of research have been carried out, and they generally all point to savers wanting a protection of principle. This is often cited as one of the main reasons for not saving more in DC schemes. Whilst this does not necessarily correspond to a need, and the need is more related to real income, which is affected by inflation, interest rates and longevity, it is clear that, such a guarantee would encourage saving and help meet the need. It also helps in retirement planning. Generally, there is a belief that lowest cost and simplicity are best, but this is not necessarily the case, and the key features of a well-designed scheme are that it provides value for money and meets the needs of individuals. For the mass market, there are two other key issues. Most individuals will want minimum involvement, and portability of fund across employers will become increasingly important as employment becomes more fluid. Employers' wants and needs are fairly straightforward, we believe. They want to offer a benefit to employees that is appreciated and represents value for money. However, they don't want it to take over their business and so need flexibility and low governance. One of the things we did during the working party was to interview a number of stakeholders, and the feedback that we got from the CBI was extremely strong that they did not want another DB. They did not want regulation and red tape to be taking over the pensions world and stopping businesses from running their own business. The wants and needs of regulators will have a strong impact on providers. We have had a number of scandals to date in the pensions and savings arena, and both parties are very keen to avoid any further troubles. To achieve this, regulation generally requires and favours simple value for money products. Clearly, providers will require and need profitable products. Is that as loud for everybody else as it is for me? Okay, I'll carry on. I'll try and speak a bit louder. Clearly, providers will need profitable products, and Gillian will talk about this a little bit more in a minute. A very large number of DC members end up in the default fund, either actively or passively. This needs to be the option, therefore, that best fits the needs and wants of the majority of members in a scheme. The Department for Work and Pensions recently published guidance on what features it feels a default option should have. Those main items, most issues were it needed to have a simple, easy to explain, high level objective of the offering. It needed to take account of the likely characteristics and needs of employees who will be automatically enrolled. It needed to be appropriately and competitively priced, and the investment strategy should reflect the overall objective of the default option and the balance between risk and the potential for growth. We believe that a fund targeting outperformance of risk-free assets, but with a guaranteed minimum level at retirement, meets such criteria if priced appropriately. I'm now going to hand over to Gillian to talk about what others do and methods of providing guarantees.
Thanks. Thanks, Scott. So the Working Party looked at what's done around the world in terms of Pillar 2 provision. And so by Pillar 2, I mean provision that's done by the employee and employer together. It's organised together as opposed to state or individual provision. And the detail's actually in the paper by country, but I just decided to summarise it by grouping the countries into two different groups. The English-speaking countries, let's call them on the right-hand side, had relatively low levels of guarantees. So as an example, in Australia, employees are obliged to have a funded pension, And there's a wide variety of different pension types, but about 80% are DC, with trustees often responsible for investment strategy. And typically, there's about 70% equity exposure for active members, and guarantees are very rare. On the left-hand side, these countries had significant numbers of people from the mass market with guarantees in their Pillar 2 provision. And there were often mandatory schemes. So, for example, Switzerland, employers have to have a Pillar 2 scheme with a minimum return, which is linked to seven-year Swiss government bonds. And this guarantee doesn't just apply on retirement, but also on switching too. Now, of course, we can look at the different approaches and just say they're historic, and it's just unwillingness of the industries in these countries to change. And, of course, the sort of pension structures that a country has tends to shape cultural values about risk and return. But the question that I want us to consider tonight is really whether there are genuine differences in mass market attitudes to risk and return between the countries on the left and the right, and whether there are actually other factors influencing scheme design, and if there are those factors valid? So we need to be quite careful in interpreting historic evidence. Are we actually basing our judgment on evidence which was gathered during a high-return world? And how much of that evidence applies in the future when we might be looking at much lower returns on average? On the other hand, is it right to assume that people want guarantees because they're clinging to the old DB schemes? Would they value guarantees as highly if they had to pay a fair price for them? So moving on to differences in political philosophy between the different governments. One goal of government is clearly to make sure that the number of people who have to rely on state benefits are limited. And you can certainly argue that the countries on the left-hand side of the first slide, in those countries, the government has exerted pressure, perhaps, on scheme design to include guarantees. And in some cases, those guarantees won't be needed and won't be wanted. Relative to those countries, the UK government has quite a non-interventionist attitude. But if we ask how much that's influenced scheme design in the UK, it's hard to actually pin it on the government, because even an extreme libertarian wouldn't mind having a scheme that had extra options available, including guarantees, providing people paid a fair price for them. Now, for a government that's non-interventionist, nudging people into default funds with guarantees does seem to solve a few problems. But perhaps suppliers don't feel comfortable with this. And I think there's a big question for our profession about whether it's our professional duty to do what we think is right for customers who don't express a preference. And how do we judge what's right? It may be that we're actually thinking that with such low contribution levels in the UK, the only chance of anyone getting anywhere near to the pension that they really want or need to have is to invest in equity investment. But are we treating those customers fairly? I would say that governments also influence design indirectly by making the suppliers of pension funds suspicious and nervous that they'll be blamed when things go wrong. In retail financial services, the pensions review and the endowment debacle have left the industry with a tarnished reputation because we didn't explain the guarantees effectively to investors. And I think suppliers of pension schemes are afraid to include guarantees sometimes in pensions design for this reason. And there's a similar motive, they're much happier doing what a customer wants than perhaps what they need, because in a bad scenario, they might be able to avoid the fallout. But actually, if you look to other industries, when operational risks hit a company or an industry, a typical reaction is to try and remove the company or industry from the possibility of further reputational risk, to stop doing that sort of business. But I would argue that some of these industries then expose themselves to the ultimate reputational risk that is not putting the customer first. And the final point on this slide is really, are we influenced as suppliers by our own high net worth views about risk and return? I'm not suggesting we're all high net worth in terms of wealth, but hopefully we are in terms of know-how and involvement in economics. And my view is that the UK mass market, capital security is key for them, and beating the bank rate. They often have a very low risk and reward understanding, but one thing that they do understand is a guarantee floor. I think explaining potential upside returns is much more difficult than explaining guaranteed floors to customers. I think the mass market are dependent on advice, they're risk averse, and they have a preference for packaged solutions. I'm hoping we'll have a very lively debate on this once the presentations are finished. I'm really interested to know whether you'd agree with me. But now I'm going to move on to methods for providing guarantees. Scott is going to present some stochastic results of some different investment strategies in a few minutes' time. And the next few slides, I'm going to actually describe some of those strategies in case people aren't familiar with them. But I want to emphasize that we need to differentiate for investors between the investment strategies on this slide and guarantees. These are strategies which ought to reduce volatility of returns, but they are not in and of themselves guarantees. A guarantee is the situation where an institution, such as an insurance company or investment bank, makes a promise that the value of the fund at retirement, if it's lower than a defined floor, for example, it will make good the difference. So first of all, lifestyling. Very common in UK DC funds. And it's based on the idea that a lower equity percentage gives more predictable returns. But it builds on this by having a reducing percentage allocated to the risky assets as the individual reaches retirement. And this gives the fund a chance to grow or recover from falls in the early years. And by investing in bonds later on, closer to retirement, it matches annuity income much better. Now, it has the advantage that it's reasonably easy to understand and explain, and it does seem sensible. But it's important to realize that this is not an investor guarantee. The saver still takes the investment risk, and I think Scott will show later that there's a very wide range of potential returns from this strategy. Nest uses target date funds, which are based on this lifestyling approach. And it also incorporates an idea of a foundation stage in the early years of contract, which is a less risky investment strategy in the first few years so that investors aren't put off making contributions by early falls in the value of their fund. CPPI is again a strategy based around what percentage is going to be invested in risky assets. But in this case, it's a dynamic percentage that's set on a daily basis based on the amount that the guarantee is in the money, how much the fund is above the guarantee, and also an assumed maximum daily crash. So basically, you can invest in risky assets to the extent that they'll fall to the maximum daily crash level. And you will hit the guarantee unless that assumption about the maximum daily crash is wrong. But unfortunately, this method introduces the monetization problem. So if there's a fall in the value of the fund in the early days of the contract, the CPPI mechanism means that virtually the whole fund is invested in low-yielding assets, but it has relatively high charges. And this happened a lot at the time of the credit crunch, but investors were given the option to accept a lower level of guarantee but still benefit from potential equity upside. Thirdly, we're going to look at volatility target funds. In this case, the percentage invested in risky assets depends on a target level of volatility that's set for a particular fund. And there's a weighted average of risky and non-risky assets based on their recent short-term realized volatility. So we're looking at the last 2 months or so of realized volatility for each asset class. And the rationale of this is that apparently there is extensive empirical evidence showing that it's good to be underweight in an asset when it's volatile, and that recent volatility is a good indicator of future volatility. So I guess it's essentially this strategy is supposed to make you quicker on the draw than everybody else in the market. But of course, and by the way, Nest tends to use these volatility controlled funds. Monetization is less of an issue, but the issue here is there's no guarantee in future that rationale will hold true. And so none of these strategies are actual guarantees. So now we get on to the situation where an institution provides a guarantee. So the institution has to hold capital because it's made the promise to make good the guarantee. And it will have to either accept that risk or dynamically hedge it. It may hedge it with an investment bank, for example, but ultimately, the person who takes on the ultimate residual risk will be dynamic hedging the risk once it gets above a certain volume. And the reason I'm talking about this is because it means that there is a certain price for the guarantee, and there's only so many levers that you can flex to change that. The price is the risk neutral cost of the guarantee. So there may be differences in terms of profit loadings that are taken by manufacturers of guarantees, expense loadings, cost of the capital that they have to hold, which depends on their regulatory regime. But really, for a particular investment strategy and guaranteed floor, for a given economic outlook, and for a certain level of charges being taken from the fund, the charge for guarantees is what it is. And I mention charges because this is a key element to why guarantees haven't really taken off in the retail world. Obviously, if you're taking charges for the guarantee and for other things such as advice and fund charges out of the fund, it becomes much more expensive to meet the guarantee. And the more the total charge you're taking out of the fund, the more expensive the guarantee will be, and particularly so in situations where interest rates are low. We call that the drag on the fund. So I just want to talk a little bit, this is the final slide from me, about why guarantees haven't really taken off in retail. Essentially, manufacturers of guarantees have two big issues. Do total charges cancel out expected return? And can they sell enough volume to make manufacture worthwhile? If you think about the costs that are involved in setting up dynamic hedging, you know, they have to sell significant volumes to be able to have low charges. But the problem was that these retail products were sold through IFAs. And there's no obvious reason why that was, because really these are packaged investment guarantees. You know, why sell them to high net worth people? The actual reason why they're sold through IFAs is because a lot of the American providers looked at our sales figures, said 80% of products are sold through IFAs, therefore we ought to be selling through IFAs. But it's not a natural place to sell them. And because they're sold through IFAs, there are big charges for advice. And most of the IFA charge for advice is about finding the customer at the point in their life when they're thinking or needing a guarantee. And of course, no customer thinks that's value for money. Not only that, But they required lots of bells and whistles, lots of complications to the design of these guarantees, which made them quite difficult to understand. And they asked the manufacturers to sell the contract with lots of different types of active fund manager, lots of funds and active fund management. And there's a big problem with this, because if you are actually dynamically hedging these risks, you can operate some of these low volatility strategies, and that will cut the cost of your guarantee. But ultimately, if you're not hedging effectively, the guarantee costs gets very high. And you can only effectively hedge funds which are really in index trackers. As soon as you have active fund management, it becomes very expensive. So the final bullet is really just suggesting that some of these problems would be solved, the problems of high costs of guarantees, if we had a default DC guarantee fund, because that would be providing volume without such high advice charges, and you'd have hedge-friendly passive investment strategies with low AMCs. And all of these things lead to low costs of guarantee. So that's all I want to say. I'm going to pass over to Scott, who's going to show us some results for the stochastic runs.
Thanks again, Gillian. Okay, one of the big preconceptions, and Gillian touched a lot about it, is when people start mentioning guarantees, everyone goes, it's like being sold a used car. One of the preconceptions are that they are very expensive. They don't provide much of don't provide much protection, and they're very expensive and provide quite an impact on the performance of the fund. Clearly, if that's the case, then the answer to our question is no, and we probably all should go home. Therefore, to try and explore this, we have built a stochastic model. It's actually a proprietary Société Générale model, so I won't go into any of the details, but if anybody really cares about it, then please come and ask me afterwards. But hopefully it's not too contentious. It's got a risk-free return of 3%, equity risk premium of 3%, with an equity volatility of 20%. To date, we've only looked at a single investment over 20 years, and I appreciate that's not really, you know, how pensions work. We are working on expanding this to 40 years and also to allow for regular contributions. But that said, you know, I think the numbers are starting to show some interesting outcomes. What we've done so far is compare a number of strategies. First one was the traditional life styling, starting off with 10 years worth at 100% equities and reducing down 10% per annum, increasing into risk-free assets. Second was a CPPI. Now, most CPPI actually tend to be sold these days with a money-back guarantee, so we've included a money-back guarantee. We then just had a straight savings, a unit-linked policy in insurance parlance, 50% equities, 50% risk-free, no guarantee. We've also looked at the same product with a guarantee. That's actually the sixth one down. I haven't got these in order. We also looked at a vol target approach, so a 12% vol. So very simply, if you look at the equity volatility being 20%, on day one, equity volatility, you're going to have somewhere in the region of about 50% in equities when you take into account the volatility of the risk-free assets as well. Again, that's basically got no guarantee, because the idea of a vol target strategy potentially is that it controls the risk and reduces the downside risk. We also did look at that strategy with a money-back guarantee as well to see if there was any value in that. And then the final approach strategy that we looked at was a sort of a variable vol target approach. Now, those of you who have looked at it will recognise that it looks a little bit like the Nest approach. I'm not claiming it's the Nest approach in any way, shape or form, but it's attempting to do sort of a foundation phase at the beginning, more of a growth phase in the middle, and then aiming towards risk-free assets towards the end, and therefore with no guarantee. Tried to keep the charging structures fairly simple. We've assumed 20 basis points AMC for passive strategies, i.e. ones that don't require rebalancing, and 50 basis points where there is a dynamic strategy. For the base run, we initially assumed a 1% per annum guarantee charge for the vol target and the unit link strategies. That seemed to be reasonably similar to the levels that we see in the markets by looking at a number of products in the sort of retail high net worth IFA market. And then 50 bips per annum for the CPPI strategy, which is about sort of the price that they go for at the moment. So what did we find out? And I apologise that it's a big table of numbers. You'll be pleased to know there are three tables of numbers. But I will try and pick out the main topics. If you look down in the black circles on the bottom but one line, you can see that the non-guaranteed strategies contain a significant risk of getting back less than was put in. So these, you know, for example, the lifestyling approach, there's a 17% chance that you will get less back than what you actually put in. Now, I appreciate this 20 years, and obviously if you go longer, then you'll get a less of an impact, but you can see that's still a significant probability and risk. And I'm not sure how many people who are currently in a lifestyle product actually realise that there is that level of risk. CPPI, which is the second, probably third column, or second product column, has the highest upside potential. That's basically because if it's going well, then you're heavily into equities, and as it keeps going well, then the top, you know, you're going to get a very strong performance. However, as Gillian said, there's a very significant chance of ending up in risk-free assets, and the actual median result is actually only 0.1% annual return after fees. So, you know, big risk there of you getting a substandard return. Equally, you can see on both the guarantee products as well that the median, and these on the bottom, on the far right, the median returns are lower than risk-free. So your probability of beating risk-free is actually lower than half for guaranteed products with 100 bips guarantee charge. So under these assumptions, I think we would argue that whilst the guaranteed products remove the tail risk, the impact on the average and median returns probably outweigh those benefits. That's at 100 basis points. If the guarantee charge is reduced to 50 basis points per annum, the argument becomes less clear. As would be expected, the guaranteed products have lower average returns and upside potential than the other products, but they do compensate this by removing the worst downside scenarios. Given what we discussed earlier about the impact that a guarantee may have to encourage saving, we believe that these distributions could easily be argued to be favourable. And the actual rationale for having guaranteed products or guaranteed return of premium or guaranteed return of contributions starts to become a feasible possibility. Of course, this is a model. So what we've tried to do is to stress test the model, to try and stress test all the assumptions. Clearly, if I increase the equity risk premium, I'm going to favour those that have high equities. But what we've tried to do is stress test some of those where it's not so obvious. And to be honest, the only one that materially impacted the answer was the assumed equity volatility. So we've done a run here with the assumed volatility reduced to 15%. And correspondingly, the guarantee charges on the unit-linked and the CPPI charges have been reduced as well because the risk is lower, so the risk, you know, the charge that you would have to charge for the guarantee is reduced. Reducing the equity volatility increases the upside potential for the vol target strategies because you're ultimately putting more into equities at each point, and it reduces the downside probabilities for the non-guaranteed products. Interestingly, I think under all of these assumptions, each of the average and median returns are above risk-free. So all of these strategies are beginning to look like they have a rationale to them. As I said, that's where we've got to so far on the modelling, and we'd be interested to hear people's views on where we could go and where we should go. As I said, we're planning to go out to 40 years. We're planning to try and introduce regular premiums. But there are still sort of practical issues around all these, and we need to think a little bit about what we do model and what we don't model. as I said, any product we is designed will have to work for regular contributions. This is actually an issue for guaranteed products because the theoretical cost to be charged depends on expected volatility and interest rates at the time of the contribution. And these are obviously unknown in advance. And so it's difficult to offer a fixed guarantee cost for future contributions. Equally, you say, well, okay, well, we have a variable guarantee charge. If you have a variable guarantee charge, this increases the admin complexity because separate funds effectively will have to be needed to be created for each contribution with a different guarantee rate. So, you know, there's swings and roundabouts, I think, on both of those. For a company that offers a guarantee that wishes to hedge the guarantee, it can delta hedge this, although that exposes the provider to the risk of increased volatility and hedge cost. The alternative is potentially to buy an option from a bank. However, we're envisaging guarantees that could be up to 50 years in length, and realistically, the availability of options on equities longer than 15 years is limited. So, you know, one of the questions for yourselves is, do you think the guarantee needs to be for 50 years or 40, 50 years, or can something like a 10-year rolling guarantee be an acceptable strategy for members and policyholders, and therefore, you know, enables it to the risks to be passed to a bank rather than be kept within the provider. There's also a question of portability. If an employee transfers from a guaranteed product, does the guarantee go with them? And we've seen around the world, in some places it does and in some places it doesn't. If so, is there a transfer price to be paid between the original and the new employer? For example, if an employer buys a derivative to back a guarantee and equities and markets generally go up, the derivative will fall in value. If that member then leaves and transfers to a different scheme, the employer will have to sell the derivative back into the market. He's going to get back a lot less than what he paid for it originally. And so there's significant loss potentially for the employer. An alternative could be that derivatives are bought within the fund and no explicit guarantee is given. We've seen examples of this in the retail savings world, but again, this may be hard to communicate. Talking of communications, there was a session here last month, the Transforming Consumer Information Working Party. They've done a lot of very good work on the communicating these ideas, and we've thought very hard about communication. We think communication is essential. It has to be. But as discussed in the sort of the DWP default option section, and Gillian also mentioned it, we strongly believe that disclosing and communicating a flaw is actually easier than communicating what an upside you might get from a strategy is. And so we actually believe that a guaranteed product could actually help communication. That is generally about it for where we've got to. You know, I would say these are tentative conclusions. Oh, I would say, I haven't got to them. There we go. Our tentative conclusions are that a large number of needs of individuals, employers, providers, and regulators could be met with the use of investment products with guarantees, in particular a return of contributions at retirement. There's a widespread use of such guarantees products in DC offerings around the world, although these vary significantly between countries, and there are clearly pros and cons between all of this, the approaches used. We believe a well-priced guaranteed maturity product could provide a strong default fund for DC schemes looking to meet the needs of mass market participants. And finally, you know, it's fair to say there are a number of challenges that exist to develop such a product, but the potential for providers should actually encourage such effort. Finally, I'd just like to say, you know, the aim of the Working Party was not to provide a solution, but to examine whether guarantees made sense, to highlight some of the tools available, and hopefully to bring some of the issues to discussion and to enable people to look at those, discuss them in detail, and hopefully one day address them to find such a solution. And with that, I thank you all, and we'll pass over to Andrew.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you, Gillian. The authors conclude their paper with a very nice paragraph. We invite challenge and further thoughts on our views, and in particular, on the wants and needs of various parties, the existence of guarantees in the pension system, comparing methods of providing guarantees, and communication and other issues. So there's some hooks for the discussion over the next 45 minutes or so. I'd also reiterate a couple of points that the Working Party is looking for your views, and this afternoon is very much part of that. And again, the focus is on the mass market and rather than the high net worth segment, so sort of focusing on the 80% rather than the 20%. I know, Paul Shelley, you have some comments. I invite you to start the discussion. In general, we have 45 minutes, and it's any comments, questions, observations, everything, everybody welcome. Paul.
My name is Paul Shelley, and I currently work here at the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries on public policy. But tonight, I'm talking from a personal capacity based on my experience working developing products for both the bank assurance and intermediary market over a number of years. I think this paper is particularly timely and welcome, and I'm sure our members will be aware of the debate that Steve Webb, the pensions minister, has started instigating about whether there is a potential for a third way for pension savings between both DC and defined benefit. And guarantees are an intrinsic part of that, and this paper addresses those issues. I think as actuaries, our skills at dealing with the interface between investment markets and the needs and wants of individual customers are particularly relevant to that debate. One area where I thought the paper needed more work, and I welcome the slides today which started to do some of that more work, was looking at the economic fundamentals behind different methods of delivering guarantees. And to my mind, when you cut through all of the detailed mechanics of it all, it boils down to two ways of delivering guarantees. Historically, lots of guarantees were provided by pooling, so things like with profits and indeed the experience of defined benefit schemes. I'd be interested if the authors think that there is any a possibility of pooling coming back into fashion, and in particular whether consumers will accept pooling across different time periods, which was one of the reasons I think why with profits became increasingly difficult to sell. And in addition, any kind of pooling mechanism would need a float to the fund, and whether people would be prepared to pay the cost of supplying that float to the fund. The other approach to providing them comes down to what are you investing in? What are you investing in? And whether that boils down to an asset strategy that ultimately comes down to some kind of sovereign debt in the underlying holder. We've seen in the markets how it's very expensive at the moment to purchase those assets, and that makes it extremely difficult to manufacture these guarantees. And some of the calculations that you show demonstrate that the end return to the consumer is actually quite low, and the probabilities of good returns in the consumer's mind of beating a zero return, the number of chances of that are sometimes smaller because of the costs of the guarantee and the other costs associated with delivering products. But consumers are buying. I think that when you look at how consumers are saving for their pensions, not all of it is within pensions wrappers. The banking industry has been particularly successful at selling short and medium-term deposits in ISA wrappers, and those products have a guarantee. And part of the reason that people are buying those products rather than choosing to invest in pensions wrappers is because they understand them, they know that they're going to get their money back
at the end of the investment period, and that's a promise that they can believe in. So I think there is a lot of work that we can do here that will be extremely useful to the public policy debate. I look forward to seeing that further work progressing as we go forward. Thank you very much.
Further question or comment, and I just remind everyone to clearly state their name before they make their question or comment. Alan.
My name's Alan Hyam. I work for Retirement Angels. Can I also welcome the work that the Working Party has done? Also pleased as a member of the Information Working Party that you appreciate some of this conclusion. So I do look forward to seeing how you use those in your final paper. My own specialism at the moment is helping people out of retirement make the right decisions. We specialise in getting those customers from employers and from other companies. So I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, really, and they are, what do you consider retirement to be when you're looking at this? You're trying to provide some form of guarantee, presumably at a retirement date, although you're not explicit in that, and what is it you are trying to guarantee? It feels like you're trying to guarantee an absolute amount of money, a cash sum, rather than a level of income. And I think it would be helpful if your final paper is clear on those areas. The second thing I would ask you to think about is the statement that you made that people are going to annuitize and that you haven't considered anything post-retirement. Now, that might be okay if retirement is 75 years when the effect of a mortality drag means it's unlikely that staying invested is a sensible answer. But if you're thinking of targeting retirement in the sort of retiring from main employment at age 65, 66, 67, then I do think there is still room for staying invested in other asset classes other than the ones that underlie an annuity. And I think that's something that needs to be considered. Because what is it you are targeting? Are you targeting a fund to buy an annuity, that's retirement, or a certain level of income, a certain level of real income? There are a number of different possibilities, and I think you've just started to scratch the surface on it, so I'll wait and see what you come up with at the end.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. I mean, I'm not intending to come back to every question, but I think that was such a fundamental one that I'd like to do so. We really kicked off with that question, you know, what did we think, you know, it comes back to the wants and needs. You know, ultimately a need is to target an income, I mean, and that's ignoring the whole piece about if you hit 65, should you annuitize, should you move, you know, have flexible drawdown and whatever for 10 years. What we decided to focus on, and it was really linked in with what we've seen in the mass market, a lot of the surveys that have been coming through, was people wanted to know that when they hit 65, that they weren't going to have lost half the money that they put in. And so what we've really been focused in on is literally just a pure nominal cash amount at 65. What people do with that cash sum at 65 is a completely different debate, you know, in terms of, you know, should you be, you know, it comes down to the work that, you know, your company do, you know, what should they be doing at retirement? We focused on very much only in getting them to retirement with a pot that is acceptable from a nominal perspective. Now, I appreciate, and you know, I think it's controversial that it's not on an inflation basis. Equally, I think it's, you know, in a real world, you'd want to be connected with longevity. You'd also want to potentially be connected with annuities if people are going to go into annuities. Ultimately, yes, I know there's increasing ability for people not to have to annuitize, but I think for the mass market will still annuitize in some way, shape or form. But I think those type of guarantees are A, too expensive, and B, too difficult to produce. And therefore,
we came back to the fact that it needed to be a return of contribution type guarantee. And the question is there a place for it? We'd like to think there is, but that's really what we're trying to get to.
There was another question
towards the back of this.
Hilary Salt from First Actuarial. I just wanted to play two ideas to see whether these are things that you've unpicked a little. The first is you said a few times that the price of a guarantee is the price of a guarantee. Of course, it's only that price if you buy it. And, you know, the price of a guarantee on my fridge is the price of the guarantee on my fridge, but I never pay it. So, you know, the price of a guarantee is only a necessary thing for you to take into account if you assume that guarantee is purchased. And I just worried a little that you perhaps had too much retail heads on rather than occupational scheme heads on, because clearly an insurer has to buy the guarantee or potentially has to buy the guarantee. But certainly within the regulatory space that DB schemes are traditionally occupied, they have not bought the guarantee. And I accept that that has led to a lot of problems. I'm not saying it was definitely always the right thing to do. But, you know, certainly there's lots of people who made the decision, and for long periods it was the right decision not to buy the guarantee. And I think that does lead us back to some of the points that were made in the introduction to this discussion about Steve Webb's idea of defined ambition, and thinking about the whole idea of pooling without promises, which I think is where we need to go. And I admit that takes a new mindset, and it's difficult to do when people have individualistic and litigious heads on. But I think that kind of leads back to the other point that I wanted to raise, which was one of the questions raised in the introduction was, will members value guarantees if they have to pay a fair price for them? Whenever anybody uses the word fair, my hackles rise always. That's the question we'll find an answer out to with our public service schemes. Because in all our public service schemes, we will have a situation where there are large numbers of members paying significantly more than their employer for a defined benefit. Now, my view is that undermines the whole basis of DB. The cross-subsidies that you have in DB schemes never mattered to members when they were paying less than half of the value of the benefits overall. When they're going to be paying for much more than 50% of the cost of the benefits on average, which could be well over 100% of the cost of the benefits for them, we will find out whether they do value that guarantee. And I do think it's wrong to start from this assumption that members value guarantees. If members really want to guarantee themselves against longevity improvements, why do they commute pension at atrocious rates at retirement? If they want to maximise their pension income, why do they commute at atrocious rates at retirement? And I think sometimes we think we know what people want, and we maybe need to just investigate that a bit further.
Thank you very much for those points. I think they're all extremely interesting. I mean, one of the other people who asked a question earlier was saying, you know, will people accept pooling, you know, as you say, with individualistic and litigious heads on? And I think, I'm sorry to keep talking about retail, but in the retail space, the FSA has been very clear in saying that cross-subsidy is something that they want to be very wary of going forward. They think of cross-subsidy as being a bad thing. And, no, personally, I think, you know, we need to think in a more sociable way and think in terms of pooling and so on, but I just don't think that's the way things are going. And when I mentioned the fair cost of guarantees, I was using it in a kind of economic sense, you know, what they actually cost to manufacture, rather than who was actually paying for them.
Paul?
There's a microphone for you.
Thank you. First of all, in the paper, when you're talking about default options, you say, you know, the aim should be to have a default option that's appropriate for a wide range of members. I'm not sure that's right, actually. I think part of the good governance of DC plans is actually understanding the segmentation of the membership and designing default options which are good for the different segments. Now, how many how many different default options that results in you having is another issue. How you communicate with the members and educate them into making the appropriate selection is an issue. But nevertheless, I think that's the way to go. And I do think that a very high proportion of members do end up in the default options. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because if they have been well and carefully designed, then you would expect that they would be appropriate for the majority of members, and therefore it's good if members actively default. So, I mean, you've picked up something I disagree with and something I do agree with in your paper. On the question of with-profits, I mean, I think the press have a sort of false impression of with-profits, and they think that some single actuary in a big insurance company sticks his finger in the air and decides what the bonus rates are. The reality is, of course, that in the bigger companies that are still actively open, there are sort of literally hundreds of actuaries doing some very high-tech work to ensure that the fund continues safely and delivers a good return. And sitting where I sit in the kind of governance of a big with-profits fund, I mean, the returns are pretty good for savers over the recent volatile markets compared with either relying on cash in the building society or investing in unit-linked products in the market. So I think with-profits is completely misrepresented and undervalued. I have no commercial interest in them being successful or otherwise. I just think they are a good savings vehicle. Otherwise, I wouldn't have got involved with it at all. So I think it'd be very interesting. I mean, you put up a table of stochastic analysis looking at different ways of providing guarantees. It'd be actually quite interesting to find some way of kind of back-testing with-profits funds against that. Or, well, you can unpick...
It's going to look horrible.
Yeah, but you can unpick the methodology that's used to run these funds. And they use hedging and delta hedging and charging for guarantees and all of the things you're talking about. Those are all ingredients of how the big with-profit funds actually operate. So I think you should do some more work, maybe get some with-profit actuaries involved in your working party, and just see. And the reason I raise this is that I think the governance that surrounds providing with profits contracts these days is very, very serious. You know, the FSA takes it extremely seriously. They don't like with profits, really, I don't think. Therefore, the companies that run with profit funds have to have very, very strong governance. And, you know, whichever route we go for DC plans, part of the challenge will be introducing strong enough governance to deal with all of these issues.
I really appreciate the first comment on default options. I think it's an interesting one as to whether or not there should be more than one default option. I think that's that. But you're absolutely right that it's about understanding the membership and making sure that the right bits are done. But with profits, it's just trying to, you know, I'm very happily try and model things like management actions on bonuses on. With equity backing ratios on such like, it's just then going to get very subjective, and that's the problem. Maybe I could sit down with a couple of with-profits actuaries and consultants and see if there is a practical way of doing it so that it's not just my view and it becomes a firm. Because clearly, with-profits is been a key way of providing guarantees in the past, and maybe there is a way of regenerating it and bringing it back. I mean, it probably have to come under a different name, I think, these days. I don't think it's just the FSA that doesn't like with profits. I think people like the Daily Mail are quite against it. The problem is being with profits is that it's now is finding the duration that it works under. Some of the 5-year bonds, some of the guarantee charges are getting very expensive or looking very expensive. Some of the longer bonds, again, it's difficult for the insurance companies to hold the capital against such policies. But yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah, we'll take it away and have a think about whether we can do anything.
I think it would be a really nice thing to show, actually, if we could. But I agree with Scott in some of his concerns, because I think, you know, even at the point where people were getting the guarantee and the with profit, they didn't seem to be appreciating it. And I think it would be, you know. Everything in the press, they were reading the press and actually thinking, oh, unit link would have been better for me than with profits, even at a point where the markets crashed, which didn't really make sense, you know. And I think it would be nice to be able to show it alongside the unit linked options.
You can, of course.
I don't think the guarantees in with profits are necessarily the major feature, actually. I mean, terminal bonus is not guaranteed. I think it's the smoothing of investment returns, the protection from the downside volatility of the market, the price for which is losing some of the upside, but over time, because of the concept of asset shares, actually getting an overall fair return. So kind of the longer the period that you have your product for, the more chances you have of feeling that you've achieved the full return on the asset shares. But I mean, guarantees is part of the means of delivering it, not the product. And I think the objective of what you're seeking is how to develop a safe DC plan for members, you know, that meets their needs, and that's pretty much what With Profits was designed to do. And I know it's got a bad name. I understand all of that. I just think actually there's a huge amount of product development gone into With Profits, which shouldn't be set aside because it's very much trying to address the same issues that you are.
We have a topic of a new working party. Let's bring back With Profits and a volunteer for its chair. let me just reiterate something that Gillian said, which I found was profound, which was there is a big question about whether it is our professional duty to do what we think is right for customers who don't express a preference, and wonder whether we have any comments on that or anything else. Anyone else wish to speak next?
On a lighter point, with the Chris Lewis. Chris Lewis. On a lighter point, I think with regards to the reputation of With Profits, being attacked by the Daily Mail is probably one of the best endorsements that anything can have. But on my more serious point, I think I have a concern that if a significant proportion of defined contributions and pension funds decide to follow giving a guarantee and follow similar investment and hedging strategies, we may result in an area where there's a great deal of risk herding. And should a lot of the funds decide to unwind or rebalance their portfolios, in particular the hedges, at the same time, they may find that it's the market isn't liquid enough to do that. I'm not sure what the size of the hedges, of the 20 and 30 year hedges are compared to the expected size of the defined contribution pension schemes. But I think before recommending it as a default option for the mass market, we ought to be aware of that.
If I can comment on that, if we're talking about dynamic hedging here, I think a key thing to notice is the fact that actually the hedging instruments are really very simple short-term futures and so on. And, you know, even during the credit crunch, most of those markets remained liquid. In the States, all variable annuity guarantees were paid out on. You know, obviously there are some more complicated hedging instruments that are used by American companies who, you know, seek to hedge more of the risks. But I think Milliman did a study which showed that actually there was about 95% hedge effectiveness even over those really difficult times at the end of 2008. And really, a lot of the losses that you saw that accrued to shareholders and not investors were as a result of basis risk, which was really brought about because a lot of the funds weren't being hedged correctly. There was too ambitious investment strategies used. So, for example, you know, firms may have offered, I don't know, very high growth Brazilian shares, but the hedging was done based on the US indices. So, I think there is a lot of people have a question in their mind about, will the whole thing just eat itself? You know, the hedges that, if you're talking about huge volumes of business. But I think we can look to the States and see that actually it did work quite well.
Thanks very much.
Nope. Next one over there, please.
My name's Tony Silverman, and just a few unprepared remarks, but separate thoughts which arose in the course of the presentation. I was slightly surprised by the variation in the return from the lifestyling product. And I think if I heard you correctly, you had 100% in equities for 10 years, and then it came down. And my automatic thought was, well, in your further work, perhaps you should look at a lifestyle product which wasn't 100% in equities for the first 10 years, and which came, where the proportion of equities came down a bit quicker than you were saying as well. And I think it would probably look a lot better. A closely related point was that these lifestyle funds invest, the bond component invests in bond funds, which can be, I don't know if this is how you did it, typically committed to a certain duration, so that they're in effect rolling 5 or 10 year bond funds which don't actually mature at the point of retirement. And we need to consider what people, in effect what insurers do, and we either need to have funds that actually mature in cohorts, and or at least model something which mature, a bond fund which matures when the saver retires. The second point was actually considering what does the variation in these returns that are put up in this these stochastic thought experiments, what does that actually mean post the event? Because we live through life in what becomes a sample size of one. So, and that variation only really emerges in terms of variation between cohorts. Because if everybody just gets the actual return that life delivers in each year, then they all get the same. So the variation is entirely between cohorts, which I think leads us back to considering that if that is the risk that people like or don't like, the only way out of it is the sort of with-profit fund. And I think that probably should be should be some consideration in the paper, that the real life risk is that between cohorts and what the consequences of that are. And the final point I wanted to make was that the conclusion of the paper, if it was, or certainly a strong preference expressed in the paper, was for a default fund which was quite high in equities and was passive. And I wonder if we would, in retrospect, be seen as doing pension savers a favour if that was where we ended up, because that is subject to being gained by IPOs aimed at getting into the FTSE. Obviously, we all know it sort of already happened. And I think that probably also should be some sort of consideration. Having said all that, of course, the paper is massively welcome, and the profession does need to be seen, absolutely, to be tackling these sorts of subjects. So it's really very welcome. Thank you.
Any further comments or questions?
Yes, my name is Sherry Barnfield from Aquila Hayward. I think, as Alan said earlier, I was a bit disappointed that there was no focus, well, there's complete focus on a guaranteed maturity product rather than a guaranteed income product. Because at the end of the day, I think that's what consumers are really looking for if they think, well, they don't want to be exposed to the vagaries of the investment markets and annuity markets at some date that's been predetermined like 40 years before. And increasingly people don't know when they're going to retire. The fact of retiring at a certain age seems to be becoming less prevalent in employment. It's hard enough to predict what your state pension age is going to be at the moment, let alone your retirement age. So I think if there are reasons why you've decided that it ought to be a maturity product rather than an income product, then I think we ought to bring that forward in the future paper. Maybe it's to do with regulation and legislation, but if Steve Webb's going to drive us down in a third way, well, maybe we need to change some of those regulations and legislations to provide that sort of product going forward. So that was a general point. Then I had a more specific point related to your comparison of approaches that you're intending to do going forward. I think it might be useful, actually, to have a benchmark against what you can compare against. And I think the Nest investment proposition is at least well articulated and maybe provides you with some way of getting home the differences between the Nest approach and the various approaches you might do. So it's a sort of general comparison with a set benchmark that's out there in the industry and will be used by lots of investors, lots of consumers going forward. And maybe some points to add to the list of things you want to compare against, one of which is very much consumer understanding at the end of the day, because the approaches you're adopting seem to be reasonably sensible for a high net worth type proposition, but for a general mass market proposition, I think consumer understanding has to be very high on your list of criteria.
I absolutely agree with a lot of what you said. I mean, as I said, I think to Alan right at the beginning, we looked very hard at, you know, what is it that can be produced. And I think one of the things that persuaded us that to look at just the sort of the guarantee point guarantee was the fact that when you looked around Europe, that was quite common. I mean, there are more guarantees on what you get back at retirement than there are on income in other countries. Equally, as I said before, you know, the problems with income are extremely difficult. I mean, the longevity, what the rates are at the time, and we just literally felt that it was too difficult at the time. Now, it may well be that this is too simplistic, and potentially we need to find something in between, but our view was it was too difficult to provide an income guarantee, and therefore let's have a look at whether or not an actual at-point guarantee was feasible. Comparison with the benchmark and Nest, again, you've also read the Consumer Information Working Party paper, as that's one of their strong recommendations. And I mean, when I didn't really go through it, but on the table, one of the last lines was the probability of beating risk-free. And I actually think potentially risk-free is your benchmark, and you should be looking at beating that, and that should be part of your communication. Putting Nest in there as well is, again, you know, potentially, especially if Nest starts getting bigger pickup than has been envisaged at the moment. But Nest leads me on to another one about complication and communication. Nest is vol targeting. Most of the insurers I've spoken to over the last few years would love to do vol targeting and put it out into retail products, but haven't got a clue how you communicate it to individuals. Nest has suddenly turned up as the government-backed as pension scheme. It's going to be provided for mass market, and it's using vol target. Brilliant. You know, if vol target is suddenly now acceptable, it's a lot easier for insurers to be writing vol target products. So maybe in 5-10 years' time, we'll be criticised for not having a vol target product rather than trying to put one in at the moment that nobody can explain. But, you know, I really take all your points, Jerry, and we'll take those forward. So thank you for those.
Do we have time for one or two more questions? Do we have any takers?
My name is Bryn Davis from Union Pension Services. I think that this is an area where the profession needs to take a lead, explaining what people need. And though I fully welcome the work of the Working Party, I'm not yet convinced that they're leading us quite where I would want them to be. But that's part of the ongoing debate. Practical point I make is I'm not convinced that someone at the 80th income percentile has the same need for guarantees as someone at the 20th income percentile. I'm particularly concerned, say, at those between the 20th and the 40th. And there, I think, picking up points which have been made, some sort of income guarantee is required on top of the state pension. That's what those people are looking for, some form of income guarantee. And I'll just take the opportunity to make the point that sort of guarantee, I believe, can only be made by the government. The government needs to issue some sort of pension bonds. And I'd all make the modest suggestion that they could do it on a sort of collective basis, and we could all even call it the state earnings related pension scheme.
disagree with you, to be honest. You know, it would be nice for the government to turn around and offer the guarantees on these types of things. And, you know, if it was an income, even better. But unfortunately, I'm not Steve Webb. And even if I was, I suspect I wouldn't be overly keen on putting additional pension burden on the on the country at the moment.
It's your last chance. Go on, Alan.
It's just a few thoughts on communications to members. This is an extraordinarily difficult area, and there's a chicken and egg situation as a recent entrance into the IFA market. I've been trying to do a lot of the principles that you've considered for people at the point of retirement. And the reason why I focus so much at the point of retirement is that all the research shows is that people are much more willing, to the extent they're willing at all, much more willing to engage and think about the subject matter of their finances and their savings and the adequacy at the point of retirement. And in many cases, individuals first really start to seriously engage with that approximately 3 months before they leave employment at whatever ripe old age that is. So the guarantees are more valuable and more meaningful to people then. You will get more engagement. And I think you might have more success in seeing, you know, vol-targeted products introduced in funds closer to retirement than you would, say, as a default fund for an occupational pension scheme, which sort of brings me back to the point I think Hillary was making and saying is, if you're going to do this as a way of accumulating money, then I think they largely have to be default funds, and to expect members in that sort of mid-ranking to actually engage and understand is probably a stretch too far.
And I'll come back exactly to what Paul said before. You know, maybe it's not the only default fund, but for a large number of people, we believe that, you know, if you put up those kind of tables and showed them that, I mean, you know, and the model's a model, and I totally appreciate that. But if you said to someone, you know, you've got a 17% chance of not getting back your money in 20 years' time, how many people would say, well, actually, I'm prepared to give up a little bit of the upside to protect myself against that situation? And, you know, that's really where the debate needs to go, to understand whether that is true or not.
There's probably time for one more question, if anyone wishes to take it. Total silence. So, it remains for me to express my thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of us, to the authors and all of those who have participated in this evening's discussion. It would be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the British Actuarial Journal if you could hand any prepared notes to the members of the events team at the back of the hall before you leave the meeting. The next sessional research meeting will be here in London. It will take place on Monday the 24th of September, so we'll have a summer holiday first. We're in a meeting about mortality improvements by socio-economic circumstances in England, 1981 to 2007, will take place. I declare the meeting closed and invite you all to join me in continuing tonight's discussion over a glass of wine in Council Chamber. Thank you very much.